Hello and welcome to Sandy by the Sea, a snapshot of cultural life and the arts on the island at the end of England. I'm James Sandy, and in this programme I speak to Steve Pitt from the Cellars at Eastleigh about his recent battle to save the venue, its ethos as a community music and comedy space, and how he came to music promotion and management. And if that's not enough, we also reminisce about acts of the past and dream of those of the future. Well, I'm very pleased to be joined by Steve Pitt from the Cellars at Eastleigh. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me in, James.
It's very nice to see you. And you're no stranger, I believe, to radio studios and the media world.
No, done a fair bit of it at different times. It's usually under quite random circumstances, but we actually planned this, so that's quite nice.
Well, indeed, yeah. It's always best to plan, isn't it? There's been a lot in the news recently about the Cellars at Eastleigh. Initially, it'd be useful just for you to tell us something about the venue itself and its history, really, because I think people know where it is, but perhaps they don't know that much about the venue.
I went to the Cellars in, I believe it was 1998, as a relief manager, and I was supposed to be there for 4 weeks. I'm still there now, and it's nearly 2012, so that tells you something about the hold of the place on people.
Have you had a pay slip yet? That's the key thing.
Not recently, no.
Oh, right, okay.
But ended up, the owners at the time wanted to dispose of it, and I bought it and held the lease for many years. And then when the recession kicked in, it's pretty much public knowledge that things got very tough. I ended up having to cease trading there myself, and at the same time as Enterprise Inns had the site up for sale, it was the only way it was going to be saved, was if I wasn't directly involved in owning it anymore. That enabled a tenancy to be put in place, and some people showing goodwill to get involved and take that on, kept me on, so I still pretty much do all the programming, all the organisation, and from the public side of things, little changed. And then recently in September, we found a new buyer, and they bought the freehold, and again they've asked the current operators and myself to stay on and continue to operate it as the music venue it's been, especially in the last 8 years, welcoming touring acts from all over the country and indeed the world.
I imagine there were some very hairy moments, because I think it went quite close to the wire for the venue.
Close indeed. It completed on, I believe, the 12th of September, and if it hadn't completed on the 13th of September, they were going to sell it at auction to whoever wanted it for development, so it would have been gone within 24 hours. Not a pleasant time.
No, so I suppose lots of cups of tea that day.
Yeah.
Tell us something about the ethos of the venue, because it's very much pitched as a community venue, and you don't just put on bands, you do a lot more than that.
Yes, we do. I mean, music is the core of our business, I suppose that would be the best way to describe it. But we've run a comedy club since 1999, and tried to sort of put in local comedians at different times along the way, along with national touring artists. Max and Ivan, who've recently been successfully signed up with Catherine Tate's management, were on at the Cellars 2 or 3 years ago, and I introduced them to their agent. We tried to help people in those. It's only in a small way, but just to try to make connections for people. And in the same way with the community side of things, local artists, helping them to develop their techniques and introducing them to different opportunities, working with the local colleges. Portsmouth College actually had me to go in last year and do a lecture on tour management and those sort of things, so that's another side of what I do. So just generally about encouraging and nurturing the local talent alongside the professional touring acts, and giving people an opportunity to see how the music business works overall, rather than just having a room, putting on gigs, stop at the end of the night and move on from that. We try to do more.
And how difficult is it to maintain that? Because some of what you've described are new, up-and-coming, or people that perhaps even haven't tried playing before, you know, kind of in a public venue. I imagine it's quite difficult in terms of, you know, you've got to make a profit, you've got to kind of keep things ticking over, but also you want to keep that focus. That's quite a difficult balance.
It is very difficult, and much harder in the last 3 years since the economic downturn. And you have to be firm to make sure that you're putting on shows that make sense economically. It's not a funded organisation. We don't have £100,000 a year from the Arts Council, for example, to do what we do. But that goodwill does involve forming partnerships with the local colleges, and therefore we can offer a professional performance experience for the students, and they bring in business to us during a quiet period of the week. And also, we offer very strong incentives to the local bands financially. So that if they put on their own headline show and do all the work and put in a lot of people, we do very well over the bar or the venue does, and it enables us to hand a lot of revenue back to them, which pays for them to go in the recording studio or maybe fund a mini tour. So it is very much a partnership, and if any part of that broke down, it wouldn't work.
Just describe for the listeners the Cellar's venue, because it's quite an unusual venue in some ways, and I like to think of it as a bit like the TARDIS. You know, it's kind of, it's something recognisable from outside, or you know, from a past age, perhaps recognisable, but Quite an interesting setup that you've got actually inside.
It is. I mean, until 2006, when there was a lot of work done structurally that didn't make a huge impact inside visually, but actually it did change it quite a bit. It involved reconfiguring the back of the premises and moving the stage back about 15 feet, which gave us quite a large area that we never had before. I mean, when Glenn Tilbrook from Squeeze played at the Cellars, he played to 80 people standing in front of two bench seats because that was the only place we had to put him. So it was just after that the work was done. And the venue holds, it's licensed for 140 bodies on site. That includes the musicians and the people working there. So usually that means 120 punters through, although if it's a single solo artist, that can go up to about 130. So it's a warm and cosy space with 130 in. It also depends on the demographic as to body mass index and who's in there. 120 18-year-olds take up no room at all.
I guess that means some difficult negotiation on the door sometimes.
It can do a little bit. I mean, somebody the other week said, oh, please squeeze me. And I said, but you don't understand it. We've gone beyond squeeze. There's people still up against the back doors. There is no room to get in the venue. But it does work, and the stage is a big enough space. We've had a 9-piece ska band on there, and it's not a big stage.
No.
But everybody loves the atmosphere, so they'll make do. I remember the Zombies coming in to play at the Cellars and say, we'll never ever be able to set up on this stage. And you just convince them that you do know what you're doing and you'll work with them, and we make it happen. Mama's Gun only last week said, well, I'll sing on the stage and the band will set up on the floor. And I was like, no, we'll make it work, it'll be okay. And it always does. Fingers crossed, we've always managed to pull it off. And you know, with, if that venue's got 120 people in there, the atmosphere is electric because it is a small space, and they're right up close and personal with the band that they've come to see, and it's got a kind of magic about it in that way that you don't get everywhere, and the bands love it.
And it's the kind of venue I love because you can very much see the beads of sweat on the artist's brow,
or feel it sometimes. Yeah, indeed, enough indeed. At the front. Yeah.
And sadly, those kind of venues are endangered species. Really, yeah. I'm thinking personally, I used to live in Kilburn in London, where the Luminaire used to be. A much fated venue, and sadly has disappeared since. And
well, it's funny you should mention the Luminaire, because I've actually got a sign on the wall in the Cellars, because when the Luminaire first opened, it won Best Small Venue of the Year 2 years in succession because of their ethos about putting all the focus on the music and the performance, and it not being an excuse to go out for a beer and have live music, as I like to call it, as a wallpaper. It's not about that. It's about being the focus of the evening.
Yeah.
And they've always done that. And they used to have signs up saying, if you come here to talk to your friends, you're in the wrong place. You've come here to listen to live music. And we try to encourage that same ethos at the Cellars. You know, the demise of places like that, and there have been a whole host of them over the UK in the last few years. It's very, very sad. And it's great that the artists, when they come down and play at the Cellars, they really value what we have to offer them, and the support that we had during the difficult period from people like Tom Hingley from Inspiral Carpets, Mark Morris and the Blue Tones, Nick Kershaw and Chesney Hawkes came down and did a benefit concert for us. You know, that gives you an idea of the level of respect and appreciation that we get, not just from the audience, but from the artists as well, which is absolutely fantastic and what keeps us going.
And there are, on the plus side, I mean, there are venues, what I would call intimate venues, that are on the up. I'm thinking Bush Hall, for example, in Shepherd's Bush. And then I suppose more locally, you've got the Brook in Southampton, which is a very small venue, in fact. So there are encouraging things. It's not all doom and gloom, but it is getting tougher, as you say.
I suppose, ruthless as it is, it's during any tough economic times, it will be survival of the fittest, which is why we've tried to make sure that we're not a tribute band venue or an indie venue or a retro venue. We are a venue that welcomes all styles of music and all age groups. And it's one of the things that makes it nice to work there, is you can have 120, 50-plus-year-olds in on one night of the week seeing ex-members of the Kinks playing on stage, and the following night they'll all be around about 18 watching a new indie band that's coming out. So it's about keeping the focus constantly shifting rather than trying to concentrate on one thing. And I think those venues that were dedicated to one style of music have been hit the hardest.
Mm. So it's a real mix, and that goes back to what you were saying about having a kind of community focus, community ethos.
Moving on to some showbiz questions now, because I'm conscious that you're a showbiz hound, as it were. Tell us about some of the kind of the more memorable acts that you've had at your time at the Cellars, because you have had some big names, or at least people from big names who've gone off and done offshoot things, and some very interesting sets that have been played over the years.
We have. The first touring artist we ever had in was Boo Hewardeen, who had been nominated for an Ivor Novello Award, wrote The Patience of Angels for Eddie Reader. Mm-hmm. And people, I remember that people that night saying, how on earth did you pull this off? And with no disrespect to Boo at all, that he's now part of what we would call our normal programming. So it has been quite a dramatic shift over the years. Mm. And he's a phenomenal performer, has been back with us two or three times. I remember the first time we had the Zombies in, people didn't quite believe that. They thought it was a tribute band. I said, no, it's Colin Blunstone and Rod Argent, and it is, it's them. And the sense of disbelief from people and the speed at which tickets went when people realised it was the real deal. And I remember Rod Argent on stage that night saying, what an amazing place this is. And you just think, for somebody like that to get it and to go with the vibe was incredible. People like Hugh Cornwall choosing to play at the Cellars as a warm-up when he was headlining at Guildfest the following day. Mm. Hazel O'Connor, Nick Kershaw, Howard Jones, Midgeur, who plays in quite big venues, even doing his solo show, came down and sold out at the Cellars Christmas before last. The Alabama 3 did an acoustic show, which we sold out in 24 hours. The Blow Monkeys, China Crisis, so showing my age now, my favourites of that era. But then again, people like Mumford & Sons coming in just before they broke. Within weeks, they were getting extensive airplay on the radio and they were a big band. Eliza Doolittle, another one, just before she broke, was with us. Other artists who've had good, big success, like Lauren Pritchard. Charlene Soraya has been top 10 recently. She performed at the Cellars about 18 months, 2 years ago. Hmm. John Allen, who's led loads of airplay on Radio 2. Also, I think you'll get from that it's not, for me, one specific thing, but it's all the different types of artists who appeal to different age groups. And there's been some real wins in there over the years.
Just tell me, how does some of the kind of elder statesmen, if you like, of rock and pop kind of respond to playing in your venue? Because I'm guessing that, critics are vicious people and sometimes say, oh, look, this is what they're reduced to. But actually, it can be often part of their rebirth, can't it, or their resurgence.
It can. I mean, that whole why are they playing in here type thing, or what's this come to that they're playing in, it's a bit half empty, half full glass type thing there. Mm. Because there's two ways of looking at it. I would say, aren't we lucky to have that person coming in to play in such a small room? If usually when you look at the rest of their tour, they'll be playing in much, much bigger venues everywhere else, and it's just because of our reputation that they're prepared to step down to a small room and play. So someone like Nick, for example, would play to anything up to 300 people in a venue anywhere else in the country. And the fact that he's played at the Cellars three times is testament to the fact that he enjoys that experience. Midgeur is another one who would play in a 600 or 700 cap venues, even as a solo artist, and yet will step down and play in our little space. So it's not about what have they come down to. It's about, and it's, again, this goes back to shouting about Portsmouth. It's what we're able to achieve. Mm. And the things that the theatres, the Guildhall and the Wedge and the Cellars are able to draw in to play in those spaces is a testament to the work that the teams that operate them do to create the right atmosphere for those artists to want to come. So it's, I remember China Crisis going on stage and Gary saying, oh, my living room's bigger than this. But, well, I haven't got a PA in my living room. It's kind of one of those. A great night and a great experience. And I can honestly say that we've never had any artist come in and at the end of the night leave us saying, well, I'd never come back here and that was embarrassing or anything like that. It's always been very positive. And the audience, likewise, have always, really good vibe from them. So it works.
Let's enter dream space now.
Yes,
and
okay.
One question I'm quite keen to ask you is, In terms of acts you'd love to see play at the Cellars, what would be your first, your choice, your paramount top act that you'd like to come and
Well, funny enough, it used to be, the answer to that question would have been a few years ago, Nick Kershaw, because I was a real fan back in the early 80s. I saw him come out on stage when everything was mimed on Top of the Pops and people didn't play their instruments. And he came out and did a Secret Policeman's Ball with his whole band and played electric guitar and sang and performed as a proper band. And that was quite a big thing then. But we've done that one now. You got him out of retirement and then he's gone on to other things. A dream came true.
Yeah.
And that was the result of a group of us saying, now who would we like to get in? And it took 3 years to get him to come and do it. But the ultimate dream one is definitely Neil Finn from Crowded House, who does do some little gigs from time to time. And yes, if he ever said yes, that would every box would have been ticked, because he's a phenomenal songwriter.
I think he's currently recording with his wife, I believe.
He is. They're doing a pyjama club thing.
That's right.
That's a side project.
And a particular favourite song of yours from Neil Finn is a Crowded House song, Pineapple Head.
It is indeed. So. It's a fantastic. It's one of their best songs, as far as I'm concerned. Not that it's difficult to pick a good Crowded House song, because there's dozens of them. And they've got a huge following in Portsmouth. Just after Paul Hester died, they had to pull the show that they were due to do at the Guildhall, flew home very sadly for the funeral, immediately afterwards came back, rescheduled the show, and played to a sold-out Guildhall, very poignant performance. And, every song of theirs is a classic, but the track I've picked is Pineapple Head, which is a great song.
OK, let's hear a bit of that now. Tell us a bit more about your background, which I'm interested in, because as you said, you were kind of thrown in as a as a relief manager in 87, did you say, I think?
Sorry,
I'm ageing you rapidly there. So what kind of things had you done previously, and what brought you to kind of where you are? Because I imagine that when you sat down at school with your careers advisor, you perhaps didn't say, oh, I want to manage a community music venue.
No, it's interesting. The early signs are probably there, although I never kind of, you don't notice it as you're growing up. You only, with retrospect, you look back and think, oh, maybe I was destined to do this. I remember setting up my first school magazine when I was 10, very precocious, running another one when I was at senior school, directed and did on lighting and stage management for school shows from when I was about 11. My mother had grown up in a show business background around musical theatre, so I was used to that environment, so it came very naturally, and I didn't really think about it. I was never a natural performer, so doing all the backstage stuff kind of appealed, and then carried on doing that sort of thing. Went to a uni, and while I was at uni, developed a quiz night business back when quizzes were fairly new, and it was based around live music, and used to travel all over the South doing that for corporate events. Natural extension from that was to go into being a DJ, doing bits and pieces of radio stuff along the way. So kind of sort of drifted through, ran a social club for a few years when I got tired and wanted to be in one place for a while.
Did you do any bingo?
I did, yes. I used to do bingo. In fact, I even used to do camp bingo as part of that. Which was the most popular form of bingo we did. And then when I left there, was doing promotions and stuff, and just generally being around the area, doing all sorts of comparing and those sort of things. Went into the Cellars for 4 weeks. And gradually, while I was there, the network of people that I knew in all forms of entertainment increased. And then in 2004, met up with a chap called Ian Martin, who runs a company called Stiff Promotions, nearly 8 years ago now. We still work very closely in partnership with each other now. And through that, developed the touring side of things. And it was an evolutionary process. So I think it's a case of life's what happens to you while you're working out what to do with it, one of those. And it's gradually happened, and it's still an evolving process now. And I think if you just embrace those things in life rather than sitting there concentrating on it too much, it's more likely to develop in a natural way, I guess.
And talking to you, I mean, you're obviously evidently someone who's very passionate about music and the arts, and that makes a real difference, doesn't it? Because quite often venues, or increasingly larger venues, are run by bigger companies who are perhaps that step back from the act or nurturing the act.
Yeah, I mean, I do go out and run tours all over the country, and that was an interesting step for me, because I am critical about what we do. I don't sit back and think we've got a fantastic venue and, you know, don't need to do anything. I'm always looking for ways to improve it and making sure that we are doing the best that we can. And going out and doing some of those venues that are run by the corporates was an eye-opener, because we do not treat people like that. We're very much, first thing when they come to your door, you want a tier of coffee or something to drink and welcome people and make them feel comfortable and get their confidence. Whereas you can walk into some of those venues, nobody even notices you're there for an hour, and then somebody stumbles up to you, oh, why are you here? Well, we're actually performing tonight. Are we in your way? And yeah, that's a very different environment. And the artists, whilst they recognise that a lot of them, they need to do that, because, you know, it's access to a national touring circuit. The independent way of doing things, there'll always be a place for it, I think. And I think the one thing the recession has done is push some people back in that direction. The corporates have got very tight on who they are prepared to take a risk on. They tend to book one act across all of their group, and that doesn't work for as many different acts as it used to. So people have sought out different performance places. Mama's Gun were a good example. They're a well-established band, played Goodwood Revival last year and those sort of things, Vintage at Goodwood they were on, came into the Cellars and had a storming night. There isn't another venue that's naturally for them at the moment, in Portsmouth anyway. So the fact that we do fit that niche is massively to our advantage, I think.
And I think that kind of that warmth of approach, if you like, sort of, I suppose, builds affinity, doesn't it? So they're much more likely to come come back and to, you know, speak well of who you are and what you do.
And so. And word of mouth is always the best form of advertising. And the number of recommendations that we get, too many really, inbox gets crowded with stuff. We'd love to come and play, which is fantastic, because it means that, you know, we are sending out people at the end of the night with a feel-good factor, and they feel that they've been respected for being there. I always say, I don't understand why a venue would not show the artist ultimate respect, because effectively you're hiring their labour for the night. So the better they feel and the more warmth they feel from us, the more warmth they're going to give out, because they're going to be relaxed when they go on stage. The audience are going to sense that. They'll respond to it. The whole thing works really well. If somebody's being ignored when they've arrived, the sound check hasn't gone well, they haven't been looked after, they're going to go on stage not necessarily with the right mindset, and a real pro will carry it off. But there's that undercurrent of lacking in warmth, and it's no exaggeration to say that 9 times out of 10 the artist whilst on stage will pay tribute to the venue and the sound man, and that's what we love about that we put that across.
And I think that's probably quite an organic process, isn't it?
It is, very much.
It's very difficult to kind of bottle and replicate, really.
You can't
it?
And it's the same as putting atmosphere into the venue. I mean, the Cellars is a weird space. A lot of people walk in and go, oh my, really? But once they start to feel the atmosphere, then they respond to that. You can't artificially create those things. They either exist or they don't, and people would sense very quickly if we were faking it.
So, Steve, tell us about the challenges that face you in 2012 and beyond for the venue. You've had a sort of gigantuan task of saving the venue. What's on the horizon? Because again, these are sort of dark times potentially.
They are. I don't think any of the challenges are going to change for the next 18 months. It's going to be difficult, and persuading audiences to come out and keep supporting us, and that's ultimately what we need to do, is keep ourselves in people's minds. We've got a strong mailing list, and keeping the diversity there, and, you know, getting ourselves into the colleges and making people aware, and finding new ways to get people to engage with the venue. I mean, one of the things we've developed over the last couple of years is fringe theatre, and we've developed that with the recent Halloween run that we did, because one of the other things I do is directing theatre, and the little company that I work with, we did 3 nights this time for Halloween, and you get about 60 people in the Cellars seated in a theatre style for that, because we've got the stage and we can light it and good sound. We sell out 3 nights now, and we're looking to increase that. I'm talking to CADS about doing a production with me in 2013. We have a couple of touring theatre groups that come in. Instant Soup, which is mainly based in Havant, they're coming in December. So trying to develop the theatre side of things, re-establish comedy, everybody's trying comedy, and we've kind of been a bit diluted from that. But I've just confirmed today that we've got Boothby Graffo with us in March, who is an amazing comedian. And so that's a good one. We're trying to re-establish that again and keep the diversity, work with things that are all about the song competition, where we, you know, showcase local songwriters and try and grow that again this year. Looking to bring in Southampton and Brighton, but keep the focus on Portsmouth. And it's one of those things where give up lots of time to commit to other projects, which I do with the Culture Partnership and stuff at the King's and the New Theatre Royal. I'm doing a fundraising gala for them in January. And because I'm involved with those things, the spin-off is that people remember that I'm involved with the Cellars. So you get the benefit of doing things to help other people whilst keeping yourself in that focus. And that's where partnership working really comes into its own, that if everybody's helping everybody else, do lots of shared work with the King's and the New Theatre Royal, and also the Jeff at the Wedge. And if we all help each other and keep having the conversation and seeing how we can improve things, then we've all got a chance of surviving. And that's what ultimately is the most important thing.
And who else have you got coming up in terms of music acts for the next sort of couple of months? You always have quite a varied programme. Who have you confirmed recently that folks might be eager to see?
Well, my older crowd will be particularly interested to come see Gino Washington in February.
Is he with his Ram Jam band anymore?
He does do a Ram Jam band tour, but I don't think there's any original members in it anymore. But this is as a 5-piece, so it'll still be a full on show. Mm-hmm. And that's I think the 24th of February. He's with me. We've got various things plumbed in for next year. A lot of the indie stuff doesn't tend to get booked until a couple of months in advance, so there's not a lot of that in, although we've got Gabriella Aplin in next year, who's got a big following and is a really popular artist. I've got Sherman Robertson back with me in June, who's always very popular in the area, because two of his touring bands are from Portsmouth. His old touring band are from the area. Gary Shaw, who now heads up music at Southdown, used to be in his touring band. And Bernie Fox, who plays with the White Knuckle Blues Band, was his drummer for a while. So there's strong local connections there. We've got quite a lot of local gigs. We've been working in partnership with Jurassic Mark, who were Southampton-based, but now do lots of stuff in Portsmouth. Who else have we got in? We've got PJ Wright and Dave Pegg. Dave Pegg, the legendary bass player from Fairport Convention, with us at the end of November. Hoping to just keep plugging away and get... Miles Hunt from the Wonder Stuff's booked in February. There's another one. Just keep plugging away and getting more and more artists in for next year. But it gets easier as time goes by because people know who you are. So you just have to be patient and then the inquiries come in. But I still... One of the fun things I like to do sometimes is just sit and scout around other people's websites and see who's out and about and then dropping them a line. Any chance you come down to us? And there is a sort of network of us around the country who do interact with each other and give each other tip-offs as to who's doing what. And that does work.
And where should folks go if they want to find out more information about listings and current detail? What's your web detail?
Nice and easy, thesellers.co.uk. So Sellers, C-E-L-L-A-R-S. And the great thing is, if you can't remember the .co.uk bit, just type the Sellers into Google and it comes up top pick. So
that's excellent. People pay millions of pounds for that kind of thing.
They do, and I get offered to have the opportunity to spend that money and think, well, we've already got that, so thank you very much.
I'm sure. Just to finish, you mentioned Nick Kershaw a few times, and you mentioned, I think he's probably one of your heroes.
He is a bit. So he'd be really embarrassed if he heard me say that.
We've got another track just to play a snippet of. You mentioned that he was your sort of dream act that you managed to bag.
Yeah.
And for you personally, what kind of achievement was that? I mean, is that something that took a lot of persuading, or was he...
Well, it did, because he wasn't touring. He hadn't been doing anything much for a few years. He did a few here and now tour things, but he hadn't done much solo work. And I dropped a line through the website several times and eventually got direct contact with his partner, Sarah, who's now his wife. And she said, oh, no plans at present. So about once every 6 months, I just dropped her a line saying, hope you're well, don't forget if you change your mind. And then completely out of the blue, Christmas 2007, suddenly sends me an email saying, hope you're sitting down. He actually said yes this time. So we booked in a night for, I think it was the end of May, sold it out within days of it going on sale, put in a second night, sold that out within days of it going on sale. Nick was quite shocked, didn't think that the draw for, as he puts it, him sitting on the stool singing some songs would actually be there.
You called his bluff, as it were.
Indeed, but it worked. And we did those two gigs and we hit it off and got on really, really well. And as a result of that, I ended up touring with him and doing his acoustic agency stuff for the UK. Mm-hmm. And we've done 35 gigs together. And it's always a pleasure being out with him, because it's always that concern when you meet somebody who's been a bit of a hero. What are they going to be like? But Nick is one of the nicest people I've ever met. He's a lovely, lovely guy. There's no ego at all. He's very grateful to still have the support that he's got. Currently writing a new album, which is going to be out next year. And I'm glad to be able to call him one of my mates these days. He's a really nice guy.
They say never meet your idols, but in this case
it paid off.
There we go. Steve, thanks very much for coming in. Thanks for your time, and thanks for talking to me. That's it for now, and I'll be back in the new year. To catch up on previous shows, go to www.kingofthebuttons.co.uk. Sandy by the Sea is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.